The Supreme Court is set to hear oral argument in Donald Trump's presidential immunity case. Harry Littman, former federal prosecutor, is here to discuss the case and what to expect. Welcome to Defending Democracy. I'm Mark Elias. Let's get started. Welcome, Harry Littman, to Defending Democracy.
Mark Elias, very good to be here.
So I want to jump right in and ask if you could give people a bit of a backdrop of what this Trump immunity case is about, what the Supreme Court's going to decide, and why it is held up, this very important case in Washington, D.C. from going forward.
Yeah, it's actually, I think, a fairly complicated question. You could say what it's about and what the arguments are. But in brief, right, he is arguing that he cannot be prosecuted criminally. And he has a series of arguments that are, I would say, far-fetched and overreaching and muddled, but they're tantamount, I think it's fair to say, to asserting that a president is above the law. They're dressed up in different constitutional provisions. He has an argument dating from Marbury versus Madison, which your listeners may know is the fountainhead of judicial review. He has an argument based on a very tortured reading of the impeachment clause and an assertion that only a president who has been impeached and convicted, as none has ever been in history, might be criminally prosecuted. But he has policy arguments. But at the end of the day, it is that the president is supreme and above the law as it relates to criminal prosecution. And that with that one proviso of having been impeached and convicted, he or she simply cannot be prosecuted criminally for conduct done in office, even in a question that's now become famous from the Court of Appeals opinion below. If the president orders a SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival, that's the position that Trump was sort of forced to because his own conduct is so extreme. He's very hard pressed to say something about core functions of the president. So that really is the argument dressed up in more or less, and I would say less, persuasive constitutional dressing.
So let me ask you this. It seems like everybody agrees that this argument is not going to prevail. But you have laid out, I think, a more thoughtful approach than just he's going to lose, and have suggested that there is, in fact, a time where presidential immunity should apply and where it shouldn't apply. This is obviously a situation where it shouldn't. But how do you think about what that balance is? Because obviously, in some circumstances, presumably you would want the president to not face criminal prosecution.
Presumably, what my real thinking here, Mark, is a kind of analysis of what happened in the Supreme Court, where you recall they took a long time, 13 days before taking the case. And many people surmise that what's happening in this expanse of time is that someone was preparing a dissent from denial because the court as a whole had decided to simply either summarily affirm the decision, the very methodical, wide wide ranging, comprehensive decision of a bipartisan Court of Appeals below. And that was what took the time. But then to our surprise, they came out with a question presented, which the court crafted and no one had presented before, that used the words the party should address whether and if so, when there could be immunity from criminal prosecution. And to my mind, that suggested strongly that some members of the court, remember, there's never been a case presenting criminal immunity for a president.
And the Nixon case didn't, right?
Say that? That's right. Now, Nixon was simply about criminal process and the service of a subpoena. It suggests strongly, of course, that the criminal law applies, but immunity, we've had civil immunity, but not criminal immunity. But I think there are members of the court, based on that language, whether and if so, when, who are given pause and in taking the case and are concerned there could be some instances, and as you just adverted, what might they be? Very core constitutional functions, or let's say the bombing of, you may remember some of your listeners in Cambodia, Nixon's bombing, some people wanted to assert criminal prosecution. So very core constitutional functions that you wouldn't want a president to have be subject to criminal process. Still and all, that's a wholly unnecessary kind of detour for them to take here. And I think some among the court and almost all of the amicus curiae in favor of the government, and I want to get to this in a moment, the government itself is really urging the court not to, along the way of rejecting Trump's immunity theory, to also build in what would essentially be, you know, what the lawyers call dicta about circumstances in which immunity from criminal prosecution might apply. And the reason it's such a huge practical issue, you know, as always with Trump, we have the substance route and the timing route. And remember, we got here in immunity and sort of froze the linebackers because it gives rise to an appeal before trial, unlike almost every other claim a defendant makes, because it's a claim not to stand trial in the first place. And the tangible practical concern here is if the court holds there are some circumstances in which immunity might apply, the normal course would be to remand back to the district court to decide whether under the standards just announced, immunity would apply to Trump. Now, almost certainly it would not. And I'll repeat, at the end of the day, could be a very long day, but at the end of the day, Donald Trump will not have immunity for his conduct here. But if they, you can be certain that whatever they announce, Trump will argue fits his case to a T. And even if it's then rejected by the district court, he may have another short trip, relatively speaking, up and down the federal courts. But that short trip in federal court calendar time is another month or two and might completely tube the prospects for a trial in this, what I would argue, most important of criminal prosecutions in 2024 and before the elections, providing the people going to the polls the opportunity to factor in, have one of the candidates been convicted of a serious crime against the Constitution?
I want to unpack a few pieces of this. So the first thing you said that I want to make sure people understand is that the Supreme Court didn't have to hear this case. So how did this case wind up with the Supreme Court deciding something that everybody thought there was no need for them to decide?
Yeah, I think there's a cynical theory and a less cynical theory, although even that less cynical theory has portents for what's happening. The less cynical theory would just be the court said, this hasn't been decided before. We do have a very methodical treatment by the court below, but damn it, we're the Supreme Court. Something of this moment that's a sure entry into the constitutional law books, that's our job, and that's for us.
And it takes four justices, right? It doesn't take five, it takes four.
That's right. Well, it's actually interesting, as it came up, it was on a stay. And it's not in the actual motion that first came to them would have required five, but that we're really getting in the weeds now. So the short answer is four would have wanted to hear it. And it would have included perhaps among those four. And again, 13 days, one could really pause it. First, there were two, then there were three, then there were four, for example, might have thought, been persuaded that they need, in the first exposition by the Supreme Court, to say something about where immunity could apply. Wholly unnecessary, though. They could certainly have just taken the case, and I feel confident there were strong voices who wanted, even if they took the case, to simply affirm. Say no more than the D.C. Circuit got it right and repeat. So that would be the less cynical, and the more cynical would be that some members of the court, at least, were interested in exactly the extension of the process, including a not super slow, but not super rapid either schedule, in order to delay the point of reckoning in the trial itself.
Okay, the second thing you said that I want to make sure we clarify for everyone is you talked about the significance of the question presented. So, you know, I've argued cases before the Supreme Court. Normally, the way this works is you seek cert on particular questions, and then the Supreme Court picks and chooses. They say, well, I'm not really interested, Elias, in question three, but I like your question two. Yes. The other side may reframe the questions. What happened here?
The Supreme Court very significantly, thunderously, you could say, for Supreme Court watchers, issued a question that had not been presented to them. And the most prominent part of that question, there were actually two little wrinkles, but it's, if I recall correctly, they said the question we want you to argue or discuss is, whether and to what extent there may be immunity for prosecution of alleged criminal conduct. And there's been some people who focus on that alleged aspect to think that might have been a sop to a side that wants to say that the allegations here plainly fall outside any core presidential function. But to me, the "and if so, when" screams out that there are some justices who want to address circumstances in which immunity might exist that are afield and maybe far afield from what Trump is accused of having done. The paradigm would be foreign policy, or let's say, you know, the current controversy in the House about whether Biden or Alejandro Mayorkas are enforcing the immigration law. Could some in a contorted, hopelessly conflicted society, could someone bring a criminal prosecution against a president for that kind of core presidential activity? The Supreme Court or some among them might want to say no. You can do it for a lot of things, but not for, and now there are the words we will learn if they go this way, core presidential functions or the heart of Article II, or, you know, they have something in mind narrow than what we know in the civil realm, which is the outer perimeter of official duties. So maybe, you know, there's a heart here of criminal immunity that they want to articulate.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, the way you articulate, not that we should work out for the Supreme Court what they should do, but it strikes me that, you know, there should not be, a president should not stand trial for vetoing a bill. You know, if they think that the bill shouldn't be law, like that should not be the subject of, a president should not stand trial because they refused to enter into a treaty with a foreign country.
Or gave a pardon or whatever. And you can imagine in our troubled times, a contorted state of affairs in which a subsequent DOJ might do that, where we're right now, remember, we're only talking about criminal federal prosecution, but that's exactly right. So they may be worried about, you know, a hopelessly dysfunctional political system, which we in some ways are damn close to or have been in the, you know, in the last 7 years.
Okay. As I mentioned, I wanted to have you on specifically because you are not only a student of the U.S. Supreme Court and of appellate law, but you are a former federal prosecutor. And there are a series of questions that I get asked all the time. I mean, every day, and I'm sure you do, that I just have to ask you to answer in light of this upcoming argument.
Okay.
The first is that people say all the time that Trump is simply receiving a different tier of justice than other criminal defendants. You know, he seems to be able to badmouth prosecutors. He seems to be able to attack witnesses. He seems to make a mockery of cases. He has managed to delay trials across the board, and that he's just being treated differently than the people you would have as a federal prosecutor prosecuted. True, not true, like true with an explanation? Like, what's the deal here?
True with an explanation. Look, we do have this mantra that we express again that I think is aspirational, that no person should be above the law. But there are a welter of factors, not the, well, of course, we're right now considering whether there's a special legal rule for a president or former president. But I think as a practical matter, courts have been conscious of the political repercussions of, for example, to cut to the chase, putting him in jail for misconduct that amounts to contempt, that I think would have occurred by now. And courts, for understandable reasons, have been hesitant to pull that trigger and hesitant to actually sign the order that puts a former president, you know, in the pokey, even if it's for a day. And this is going to be sorely tested, I think, in the upcoming trial, because now that a jury, and if you'll permit me a quick detour, now that there's a jury being seated in the New York case, some of his tirades, which have been worrisome as far as safety of witnesses and the like, now are worrisome as far as integrity of process and the jury. He's got a hard-nosed judge who may really come to the point of, next time, Mr. Trump, we are you're going in, and you know, then we'll have to follow through. But I think it's just a fact that.
But I have to ask you a follow-up on that because I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
So you're saying there's a different standard for pre-trial than during a trial for his antics?
Well, I think it's a pivotal moment that a jury is being seated, because his antics now, which have the governmental concerns that have justified a gag order, have been the witnesses being free to testify, or maybe something about a jury pool generally. If he does this, you know, absolute torrent of assault on the trial process itself, and it makes its way to juror number 6. Mm-hmm. We have a little crisis here. Yeah. And, you know, because that really is potentially polluting the jury. And it's a kind of actually unwarranted. It's a kind of testimony even, right? The defendant says thus and so. It and the fact of a jury's being seated and the need to protect the integrity of the process, I think, makes it a new ball game. But back to the question, you know, I do think that judges, as a practical matter, want to do everything before putting him in jail. And I'll just say, as a prosecutor and just a trial lawyer, he has acted up, and you know, almost in a sort of dare the court way, a really sort of bellicose way, that would have resulted in a mob boss, a corporate titan, a street drug dealer, any and all of them. Remember, he's out on bail or conditions of release. Judge could anytime say to a run-of-the-mill defendant, do it again, you're going in. And would have said that, but the system overall is doing backflips not to do that for Trump. So as to the question you field all the time, you know, the courts will try very hard not to apply or articulate different law, but they are treating him, for a number of reasons, I think, with kid gloves, or at least not crossing over if they can at all avoid it. I think it's just demonstrable that other defendants in his position would have been in behind bars, at least for a short time. There would be a possibility of both criminal contempt. You did that. Go in for 3 days because you've been bad, or civil contempt. Comply with what I'm doing, and until you do, you're incarcerated. That courts have stayed away from, and I think even some of his successful skein of delaying strategies have resulted from solicitousness to the singular position of a presidential candidate being subject to criminal process. And then, of course, that's even leaving aside the argument that he's getting special treatment from Judge Cannon in Mar-a-Lago. I mean, all the judges.
I would argue it's all of them. It's New York, it's Washington, it's Georgia, and Florida. Florida may be the most extreme.
That's right. Well, and one more quick point. I think something that's interesting and overall reassuring about the January 6th case, Judge Chutkan, I think, is a member of a court that every judge on has dealt with dozens of January 6th defendants. And they are, I know for a fact, are collegial. And they are also, I think, somewhat collegial, a little bit more of a separation with the Court of Appeals. I think they really talk through and figure out, how can we handle this guy? How can we maintain the integrity of a trial, but without this complete sort of collision with Trump, which by the way, it's not simply to treat him well. I think they're justifiably concerned about the consequences for people of having a candidate kind of put away. And also, they do not want to give him an argument, which he is trying very hard to construct, of an individual animus by the judge toward him. His merits in general are poor, but this is, I think, what he's doing in New York and tried to do in the New York civil trial, is to gin up some kind of real confrontation with the judge so he can say on appeal, this judge was biased, and actually construct an issue for recusal, reversal, and the like.
Okay, the big question that everybody asks, and just bear with me and take my premise as true. Let's assume that we get a decision from the Supreme Court sometime in late May or June. I understand it could be a little earlier. I understand they could theoretically issue a decision in July. But let's just assume that it's not the last case of the term they decide, but it's not the next case. So late May or June. Is it realistic that this case gets to trial under any circumstances? And if so, what are those circumstances before the election? Or have we lost the pre-election time frame for this case?
I would say it's barely realistic. And I've actually, gotten out the calendar and tried to calibrate it precisely. First thing to remember, when this claim was raised, there's a chunk of the pretrial left that you can't curtail. It would be a violation of due process to say, okay, now we're here, let's go to trial next week. So there's that to go through. And there is in terms of your hypo, Mark, May 28th to June 5th might matter, but and certainly to June 25th, and one of the corollaries of the possible, Kremlinology of what they were doing in those 13 days is, will there be dissenting opinions, and will that push it to the 25th? But in your timeline, you then layer on the time remaining that he already had. And you then set for trial. And where you are then is, yes, there is time to begin trial and maybe not end it. That's also a consideration. Is it?
That was going to be my next question. How valuable is it
for the people if a lot of evidence comes in, but we don't have a verdict? But to begin the trial, but here's what will happen. And now we're really in kind of speculation land. But let's say it starts, and this is when it would, September 15th. Okay. Okay, now there'll be a claim, all right, it's not simply that I'm a candidate, but we are in the home stretch of the election. Court of Appeals, I bring a mandamus motion and appeal it to the Supreme Court to say you simply cannot hamstring and incapacitate a presidential candidate in the last few weeks of an election. That would be the argument. It will not. Judge Chutkan has already telegraphed that she's, you know, will not accept that view. She's saying there's that nothing about the election will intervene with the trial. But you can imagine, just as, for example, in Clinton v. Jones or even in immunity, the court really is applying a kind of a common law. There's no constitutional requirement of immunity. It's a kind of a judgment of what makes a president or an election be effective. So I think that will be a not trivial claim that will reach the Supreme Court quickly. But if they don't give a stay, yes, I think, and the timeline you said, it would start, 6 weeks anyway before the election.
Let me push back on part of what you said.
Okay.
The immunity claim that dealt with the timing in the Clinton Jones case had to do with the sitting president. Right. The idea was that this would interfere with the office.
That's right.
You may remember, and the audience probably does not remember, but, former Senator Ted Stevens went on trial, yes, and was in trial in October before the election. There has never been it would be quite a rule for the Supreme Court to adopt that, say, that federal candidates, because I'm not sure how you carve it out for presidential candidates without saying it's true for people running for Senate, for running for House, maybe running for governors. Like, you sort of create this buffer that doesn't exist, has no constitutional dimension, because after all, they're not an office holder, right? They're just running for office.
Right.
They're aspirants. And it strikes me that it would become unwieldy to administer if you start to layer in, well, they have to be serious candidates. It has to be the general election, not the primary election. So I'm just curious, do you really think that is, beyond the fact that he can raise the claim, do you really think that is something that might attract judicial support?
Yeah. So, and the Stevens point is important, but you have an opinion about this, but I think Trump v. Anderson, for example, the Colorado case, it really mattered that it's the president there. It's a national election and a national interest. You're right. It is hard to make a principled distinction, I agree, between a senatorial candidate and a presidential candidate. But do I think five members of the Supreme Court could decide that this is a special thing and there's a weighty national interest that the short answer is yes. I think there is I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand, notwithstanding Stevens. And as you say, everything in this area is just loosey goosey by design. Clinton v. They just said we have to suspend this while a president's in office because of functioning, et cetera. So it would just be a kind of realpolitik or worse, a kind of tendentious analysis because it's a president. But he'll make the claim. I think it will get, and of course he'll need a stay. I mean, that's the important practical point, right? He'll make the claim and probably not even get a stay. He'll stay in the in the Court of Appeals. Does he get a stay? And now we are in, on the threshold of trial. I certainly agree with you on the right answer. And as a predictive matter, I agree with you, but I'm going to retreat to a kind of lawyerly 3366 or whatever. Right. I would not bet the house against something like that happening. And look, everything about Trump is sui generis, but a presidential campaign coming down to the wire where the one candidate is, as he is today, in the chair, unable to be out there making his case to the American people, it's staggering, but maybe completely constitutional. But
look, I would argue
staggering,
that,
you know,
I would argue for the originalists on the court. At the time of the framing of the Constitution, presidential candidates didn't campaign. There's a, you know, but let me use the time that I have left to ask you a few other questions. Sure. The first is that, you know, we have this argument coming up on Thursday, the 25th. You're an expert. You're a student of the Supreme Court, and you have followed this case. What are you going to be looking for? Like, what are the things that people should look for at the argument?
Yeah, I want to see the vestiges of what I'm saying about those 13 days. And I think we'll know in short order whether the court, and you can almost see this physically. Here's Jackson here, and here's, you know, Gorsuch. Will there be the evidence of a clear division so that some members of the court are pushing hypotheticals about immunity that have nothing at all to do with the case, and more than just academically, are pushing the concern that there may be some instances, and we'll decide that, and then the district court could look at applying it, because that right away to me will portend the possibility of a remand. So the first thing I'll be looking at is whether there's across the transom kind of push
and are there particular justices
that goes specifically to the idea or concern of immunities being necessary in situations that may be far afield of what Trump is accused of.
And are there particular justices you'll be looking for? Because one can assume that Justice Gorsuch, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas are the most likely to be lobbying those questions that you are suggesting.
You named them. No. Yeah, those are exactly the three I'll be looking for. And I think you'll be looking for Kagan in her really piercing way, and Jackson to push back, and like everyone else who follows this court, all breath will be bated when Justice Kavanaugh asks something about this, and the chief, but especially Kavanaugh. They'll need five to get to four to admit, but they'll need five to have this kind of opinion that almost necessitates a remand. And so, yeah, those three. But then where is Kavanaugh?
Okay. Then I want to end questioning on this. And then I want to talk a little bit about your podcast and your new project. You know, Jack Smith is kind of a figure that we don't hear from often. We've heard from a little bit, but he looms large over all of these cases, and particularly this one. And you know, you said that he took a particular position in the U.S. Supreme Court, and I want you to address that. I also want you, though, in the context of that, to address a question that I hear from the right, from people who I respect, who are thoughtful on the right, who say, look, what is the government's interest in a rush here, right? I mean, the speedy trial is a right of the defendant to not have stale charges and all that. What is the government doing here? What is Jack Smith doing here on the timing issue and the process issues? So maybe you can address both what he's actually doing and also that argument from the other side.
Yeah, it's two great questions. First, in the Supreme Court, Jack Smith signs the brief, but what we want to be thinking about is Michael Dreeb. So he is the person who handles the Supreme Court litigation. And the reason it matters is in terms of the precise answer to your question, Mark, he is very experienced before this court for many years in the SG's office. He was the person who always made all the criminal law arguments. And when he says things, they know that he's, you know, speaking from a solid base. And that matters because what they've said, they realize this risk. I think this issue of will there be a remand is the dominant one, because it's just I think accepted by almost everyone. Trump will not win this at the end of the day. The question is, what's the length of the day? And at the end, after a 45-page argument that recapitulates what the Court of Appeals did, Smith, but Dreeben, said you can and you should remand for trial. That is, specify there's to be no remand to apply this as a legal matter and opine on whether it fits in pretrial litigation that could go up. Right away, say, try this case, and to the extent there are lingering or vestigial questions based on other things you've said, the court, district court, can handle it with evidentiary rulings or jury instructions. So they're actually going to make the pitch to do something the court, I'm not sure I've ever seen them do, but if Dreeben says it, they'll take it seriously. So even if there's more in this opinion than just going for Trump, which is what they want to have happen, but they're acknowledging of that risk, they'll say still remand for trial. On your other point, it's really both interesting and critical. Jack Smith has gotten closer in every filing to saying, try this case before the election, because there's a great national interest in the people's having this information about whether he's an adjudged felon before when they go to the polls. But that's a kind of a, if you think about it, a kind of a funky submission. Yeah. You know, why?
For a federal prosecutor. Is it?
And I think the Supreme Court itself is sort of setting itself up, unlike Trump versus Anderson, where they came out the day before Super Tuesday to say, we are indifferent about this. That is not our lookout. And actually, Smith has not quite pulled the trigger on saying it. He's just talked about the need for a speedy trial and the government's interest. But really, here we are, you know, all the criticism of Garland, all everything is because mm-hmm. there's an assumption that somehow the government should have made its interest to anticipate Donald Trump might run for president. And I think there's a principal distinction, but man, it's a narrow one between wanting to have Trump found guilty in a personal way before the election and wanting the people to have this information. And the DOJ in the person of Jack Smith are continue to tiptoe around that interest. And the people you respect, I think, have a real point of like, why is that the lookout of the criminal justice system? The criminal justice system should go methodically in the pace it normally would, find guilt or innocence, and the electoral system should go and process whatever information it has to process. I mean, case at most will have a jury verdict and it won't be a final judgment, et cetera. Why is one, you know, why is the tail wagging the dog?
Yeah. So before I let you go, I need to ask you about a new project you're working on. I have been on your podcast, yeah. Talking Feds, which I recommend to everyone. The latest episode I caught up with, you had Norm Ornstein, who is one of my favorite people, and Mauro Eliason, also who everyone knows. You have phenomenal guests, setting aside me, who's occasionally on it. And it is...
we can surely include you.
Okay. It is absolutely an essential listen to for anyone who wants to understand
really
politics and the law. But on top of that, you now have a new endeavor.
Tell me about it. Thank you so much for asking. I'm really excited about it. It's called Talking San Diego. So the same kinds of folks, not three a week, but one every few weeks, are coming to San Diego, having one-on-one conversations with me before a live crowd in San Diego. We had the first one with Jamie Raskin a couple weeks ago. We have one with Jen Psaki coming up. It'll be people on both sides of the aisle, different folks. And if people want to find out more about it or buy a ticket to the next event, just go to talkingsandiego.net, and all the info's there. But I appreciate your giving me the chance to bring it up.
No, absolutely. And if you are in San Diego or you're going to visit, please buy a ticket to it. Harry is wicked smart, as you can tell from this podcast. He's incredibly insightful. He is an amazing resource. So make sure you're subscribed to his podcast. Make sure you are listening to Talking San Diego. If you're in San Diego, make sure you buy tickets and always be on the lookout. I also periodically catch you on TV, which you're incredibly insightful on. So please, everyone, do that. And we will include all of that in the show notes. Harry Littman.
You're very kind. And I can just say, whenever anything comes up of crisis and elections, gerrymandering, I myself always say, call Mark Elias, or is Mark Elias in the building? So.
Well, Harry Littman, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks for listening to Defending Democracy. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. And to find out more and to stay up to date on the latest voting rights and election news, go to democracydocket.com and subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters. We'll see you next time. Today's episode was produced by Ali Rothenberg, Gabrielle Corporal, and Paige Moskowitz. It was edited by Gabrielle Corporal and Paige Moskowitz. Defending Democracy is a production of Democracy Docket, LLC.